Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to our exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease, heart failure, and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring contributor to our global heart health community, Dr. Puneet Garcia. Dr. Garcia specializes in the clinical evaluation and management of patients with end-stage lung diseases and lung transplantation. Dr. Garcia is the medical director of lung transplantation at Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center and associate professor of medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He earned his medical degree at Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, India, and completed internal medicine training at Drexel University College of Medicine. He then earned fellowships in pulmonology, critical care, and sleep medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. In May of this year, Dr. Garcia earned his master's in business administration from University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. His research is focused on the identification of therapeutic pathways for chronic lung allograft dysfunction and systematic optimization of post-transplant survival. Dr. Garcia is committed to positive leadership, transplant program development, innovative healthcare delivery, and the education of physicians in training in transplant medicine. Dr. Garcia, welcome to the Heart of the Matter.
Thank you so much, Gary. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on with you today.
Yeah, and it's going to be so beneficial for me and for my audience. So as we begin today's discussion, I know that you might be pleased to learn that I have visited four or five cities in India and can say that our journey was perhaps the most interesting of all the places that I've been fortunate enough to visit in my life. Can you share with me a little bit about what it was like growing up in India, and when did you know that you would be a doctor?
Oh, that is so exciting to know, Gary, that you've been to India and you know it gives some perspective, I guess. It's easier to explain. Yeah. My father was in the Indian Army, so he's a vet. And he, as a veteran, and when he was in active service, we used to be posted all over India. So I can truly say every 3 years, we moved from one city to another city where my dad was based. So I've seen all parts of India. It's a pretty large country, but my home base in India is a northwestern state of Punjab. It's on the international border with Pakistan in the Himalayan foothills. Yes. It gets really hot in the summers and winters can be cold.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I know. I was there when it was real hot, but it was so fascinating. And for people who have never been to India, it is perhaps the most extraordinarily beautiful place. And at the same time, obviously, in some of the cities, there's extreme poverty. And I was able, fortunately, to see both of those things, to see the Taj Mahal and also to see, you know, a place like Varanasi, where it was extraordinarily interesting. And again, makes you so sensitive to the poverty that is present in a lot of parts of India. But the other side of that is India is so beautiful in so many places, especially like where you attended medical school in Manipal at Kasturba Medical College. And I know that that's just along the Arabian Sea, so beautiful. And what I want to ask is, why did you leave there?
So, yeah, it's interesting. As you mentioned, India has a large dichotomy. You have the rich class, and then you have people who are working to meet their ends. And then there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in eradication of poverty, which there's been a lot of progress made. It has a burgeoning middle class, probably one of the largest middle classes in the world. So focus when kids are growing up over there, especially coming from a middle class family, is to focus on your education. So kids are encouraged to work hard in the schools, and they're always told your ticket out of middle class or out of poverty is your education. So while growing up, I wasn't a person who was really interested in mathematics or engineering as much, but I was drawn a lot to biology and chemistry. Right. And that piqued my interest. And getting into medical school in India is no mean feat. So you're competing against hundreds of thousands of high school kids who take this high stakes exam. And right. Based on how you rank, you get the medical school allocated to you. So I was selected to start my degree in medicine in Kasturba Medical College in Manipal. I'm going to age myself. That was summer of 1995 when I started. And I had no idea where Manipal was. And I took a 3-day train ride from New Delhi all the way, trains going through the hinterlands of India. And then, as you mentioned, up the West Coast and the Arabian Sea, and you land in this small, sleepy university town, which had nothing at that time except the medical school and other higher education institutions over there, which has changed since then. But that was my start to my medicine training.
Yeah, it's so funny where the road leads us sometimes. We have no idea how good it's going to be, especially when we're not quite sure where we're going. And to that, you ended up coming to Drexel University. And many of my listeners know that Philadelphia is my second city, having had my dental training at University of Pennsylvania, just up the block from where you were. So it is indeed a small world.
Right. So after I finished medicine in India, I actually spent 2 years in England, and that's where I got exposed to thoracic transplantation during my first job out of medical school. And that piqued my interest in transplantation. It was so interesting. And England, as a junior trainee, you would work in both heart and lung transplant units. So I was exposed to earlier days of VADs and transforming the lives of heart transplant recipients. I still remember one of the patients from those days, and I was so junior in my training, I was mainly following my attendings around and just trying to make sure I do the things that I've been asked as I learned the nuances of medicine. There was this young 21-year-old Iraq war veteran from the British Army who ended up with cardiomyopathy and biventricular failure on an LVAD, and he wouldn't recover. And they ended up transplanting this young guy. And within weeks, he was, after his surgery, when he did his rehab and he recovered, and he left Harefield Hospital. And when I saw him in outpatient clinics with my consultant, I was like blown away. I was like, wow, this young guy can now lead his life to a normal extent, not be worried about what is going to happen tomorrow. That led me to decide that I want to do transplant. And when I wanted to do further training, I always wanted to come to the United States. So I took my board exams and came to the US in 2004. Started at Drexel University College of Medicine, where I did internal medicine training. And then for my pulmonology, I specifically chose to go to Cleveland Clinic because of, not only because of the world-class pulmonology training, but the Cleveland Clinic's one of the largest lung transplant programs in the country.
Wow. Yeah. And that, of course, is the reason that you took on lung transplantation, that experience. And sometimes it's just a singular experience that pushes us in a certain direction. So that kind of explains why you ended up at Cleveland Clinic. And so tell us a little bit about the Cleveland Clinic and your experience there in lung transplantation.
So I started my fellowship in Cleveland Clinic in 2008. The Cleveland Clinic continues to grow every year. At that time, the department constituted of 23 pulmonologists. We were doing about 70 transplants. But within a couple of years of starting my training, the Cleveland Clinic actually ramped up its transplant program, and we started doing more than 100 transplants. And I remember in third year of my training, we actually did 157 lung transplants, which to date is the largest number of transplants performed by a single institution worldwide. I'm very lucky to have trained under luminaries in pulmonary medicine and my mentors, who to this date, I am able to lean back and reach out to them and collaborate. If I have a clinical question or research questions, I do not hesitate to pick up the phone and call my teachers and my colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic.
Yeah, and it's great with all that you know that to have other people to bounce ideas off of and to see things perhaps in a different perspective, just to make sure that you've considered all of your points before you begin these complex lung operations. I'm sure that's very helpful for you. And so now you're at the renowned Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center. And my surgeon, by the way, Dr. Brian Lima, did much of his heart transplant training there. And you are indeed a pioneer of various innovations, including the use of portable ex vivo lung perfusion for transportation and evaluation of donor organs. Now, I'm certainly familiar with transport devices such as the Sherpa Pack created by Paragonics. Can you explain to me, and especially to our listeners, what ex vivo lung perfusion is and why it is so important to people in desperate need of lung transplant?
So I would try to explain ex vivo lung perfusion. I'm going to say that if it is akin to, I call it the lung in the box technology. The lung transplant, if you look at it, the modalities of transporting lungs from donors to the recipients kind of has been stuck in the same phase of what it was being done 30 years ago to even to till this date in majority of the institutions. You are offered lungs, you go to the donor hospital, your surgeon explants the lungs, and they basically put them in a ice cooler and transport them back to the recipient hospital where your transplant surgeon then implants the lungs. So you can imagine the stress the human body and the lungs go through as they are explanted out of a human body, cooled down, put in ice. You can imagine the amount of free radicals being released and the stress happening to the organ. And then they're warmed up again. And then by warming up, I mean, they're perfused again and they're placed in the recipient. And that there's a major temperature change and the other biochemical reactions that could be going on, leading to possibly even cell death and inflammatory response, which can sometimes lead to delayed graft function after the transplant. So that led to research. This was pioneered by Dr. Stigstein in Sweden, where they thought, why don't we utilize a technology called ex vivo lung perfusion, where we develop a perfusion solution which mirrors human body's physiology and put the lungs on a circuit akin to putting a human body on a ventilator, where you are now oxygenating and you are actually circulating this perfusion solution through the lungs, mimicking the as physiological state as you can.
Right.
They realized by doing that, you can actually keep the lungs viable for longer. You can manage the ischemia time better. Ischemia times the time the lungs spend out of the human body before they are reimplanted. And they were able to prove that these lungs, which were put on this quote-unquote lung-in-the-box technology, had similar outcomes to the lungs which were not put on the lung-in-the-box, our traditional way of procuring lungs. This then led to realization that had a lot more implications to rather than just transportation. You could now take lungs which might be slightly marginal, which otherwise would be not used, put them on this lung-in-the-box technology, or EVLP. You could check their physiological measurements in 4 to 6 hours. And if the measurements are appropriate, you go ahead and transplant those lungs, and those patients do exactly similar to the traditionally transplanted patients.
Yeah.
So if some donor was in a car accident and you think there was some sort of inflammation or some bruising to the lung, you could put them in a lung in the box technology, and 4 to 6 hours later, you can visually examine these lungs. There's a surgeon who's actually, or a pulmonologist who's actually watching these lungs in real time, checking their blood gases, and be like, no, the gases look great. The lung appears healthy. We should go ahead and transplant them. Or, no, this lung isn't looking excellent. I still have the bruise. The blood gas hasn't improved. We should not transplant. So we were given that opportunity to utilize more lungs. So you were now able to use more lungs. And the era where we transplant only about 20% of all lungs that are available to us, this is kind of revolutionary.
Yes.
And I would go back to your earlier statement. I'm not the pioneer in EVLP by any means. It is my partner over here, our surgical director at Baylor St. Luke's, Dr. Gabe Luhr, who's actually leads a couple of our international center trials. And at Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center in Houston, we use EVLP quite often, and we use this technology for about 30 to 40% of all our transplant lungs.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I know similar things obviously are going on with heart transplantation as well,
right?
With DCD hearts. And
right.
Certainly my doctor is doing those now after the studies that were done in Cambridge University in London. And we are in the middle of a revolution as far as making more lungs available. We'll be wasting less organs this way,
right?
And also ensuring that the functionality of these organs is perhaps even going to be better once the patient emerges from the operation.
Right. The possibilities are limitless. You could theoretically see, say you have a lung which a patient might have a case of pneumonia. Could you treat them while they're in the lung in the box and see, check again in 6 hours are those lungs viable? Could you use biomarkers for research to see what's going on in these lungs that as they come out of the body, and how can we use that knowledge to help our transplant patients? Yeah, this is, I think this field is still nascent. It's only 10 years into its being. So there's more to come on this.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. And thank you for that. So I'll turn it back a little bit to more basic things. So what's the most common indications for lung transplantation?
So lung transplantation is offered to any patient who has end-stage lung disease who has exhausted medical treatment options. So that's how I look at it. And then when we look at diseases, the most common indication in the United States is interstitial lung disease. Mm-hmm. Or you might have also heard the term idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, mm-hmm. which in lay terms is scarring of the lungs due to a reason which we still don't know. I suspect it is more genetic, but it affects mostly folks who are in their fifth or sixth decades of life, start having shortness of breath. They go see their primary care doctors. Most of the time they're like, let's give you antibiotics, steroids. Maybe it's just bronchitis. They do a couple of rounds of that. They don't feel better. They end up getting a chest x-ray or a CT scan of the chest, which actually then reveals there's underlying scarring of their lung tissue. And that prompts a referral to a pulmonologist or a ILD, interstitial lung disease specialist. That's the number one indication. Mm-hmm. The second indication is COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, or chronic bronchitis, which is most commonly related to years of cigarette smoking or tobacco use. Yes. And these patients with COPD are generally older than the patients with IPF. They generally present to lung transplant centers in their 60s and maybe even early 70s. And that is due to advances in medical treatment. Now you have better inhalers, better drugs, and these patients are able to continue with the medical treatments and optimize their lifestyle, like stopping smoking, oxygen therapy, exercise prior to getting to transplant. But they, if their quality of life isn't good, then they should be referred to a transplant center.
I was going to say, you have so many patients that doing the wrong things that we hear about. I hope it's not too many people, but you hear about patients that go back to smoking, for example, after a lung transplant. And I'm sure that you have to screen so carefully these patients to make sure that they're going to have a good outcome with a lung transplant.
Right. We certainly, as a part of our workup, we talk to our patients. The UNOS guidelines say you should be abstinent from all forms of tobacco use for 6 months before you're offered organ transplantation or lung transplantation.
Yeah.
So we certainly check every single patient for any evidence of tobacco use by checking their urine samples for tobacco substrates.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, although it's very rare, Gary, I would say patients relapsing, I can only count on my fingertips how many patients have done that.
Yeah.
But I would say 99.9% of the patients do take great care of their lungs after the transplant because they know this is a gift of life for them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very important for our listeners to understand that if they are lucky enough to get this gift, that they have to protect it afterwards. It's the thing you have to do to respect the organ and the donor, actually. You know, so I think,
right.
Yeah, I think it's the best way to go. And thank you for making that clear that certainly most people do not abuse the gift that they've gotten. Many people are unfortunately now familiar with the term ECMO. I myself, again, was on ECMO for several weeks in 2019. I really don't know why I had to try all these things out myself, but I think it's because the man upstairs wanted me to help explain these things to my fellow patients in a way that they can better understand them here on my podcast. And so for me and my listeners, please talk about how you use ECMO in the treatment of pulmonary patients.
So ECMO is a abbreviation for extracorporeal membranous oxygen therapy. This is an advanced form of life support that is utilized when patients with lung failure are unable to maintain their respiration or oxygenation and ventilation, or their blood body's oxygen levels, or they're unable to clear carbon dioxide levels from their body with advanced life support options, even like a breathing tube and a mechanical ventilator. And that's when we think about something else to help them breathe. And that is this device called ECMO. I kind of explain it to my patients. It can be akin to using dialysis for kidneys, where you're clearing toxins from your body using an external machine. Here we are providing extra oxygen and clearing out carbon dioxide using an external machine. But it is much more invasive than dialysis. It is a big machine that goes through, as you can probably attest, through two big cannulas,
yes,
which are larger than water hoses, which go into either your groins or your neck or your chest to give you oxygen and clean out carbon dioxide.
Yeah. I was going to say to our listeners, to that, you know, my ECMO machine was sort of my roommate. It was the only thing that fit in the room, basically, was myself and the ECMO machine. So it's pretty big. Yeah.
Right. You cannot be anywhere else apart from being in an ICU while being on ECMO.
Yeah.
ECMO is certainly what I would call, in our lung patients, especially the transplant candidates, it becomes a bridge to transplant.
Yeah.
That's where it comes into play for lung failure patients. This technology, too, has evolved a lot from its earlier days where patients used to be sedated and kept heavily asleep while on ECMO due to the risk of cannulas getting dislodged and other complications. Now we've come up with cannulas which are smaller, which can go into one of your veins, either in your neck or chest. Mm-hmm. And patients can be actually awake, talk, they can interact, work on their rehab, work with physical therapists, actually get out of bed and walk around on ECMO in the ICUs while they await their lung transplant or await their lung recovery if they are not transplant candidates.
Yeah, yeah, and it's true. It's funny because I'll tell you that I created my first website while I was on ECMO. I was able to use my phone, which is pretty much the only thing I could do while on ECMO, but I did create my first website while I was on ECMO. So all those things you're talking about, I can attest to are very true. You know, it was limiting, of course, physically in one sense, but there was the flexibility to allow me to do certain things, and I was very awake during the time that I was on ECMO. So it's fascinating how far we've come with that technology. As lung transplant recipients emerge from their operations, what does life look like on the other side? Are they basically normal after their transplant? Are there great limitations on the things that they can do?
So one of the things that I tell my patients is, why are they undergoing lung transplantation? What is their motivation for that? I address that in their pre-transplant visits so that we can educate patients and tell them on the life on the other side. Most of the times we talk about survival outcome data with our patients, which are improving every single year. But the biggest thing I tell my patients is, by giving you a transplant or you undergoing a transplant, is our hope is to improve your quality of life so that you are able to do things which you are not currently able to do. You are not tethered to oxygen. You can go live your life that you want to. My patients ask me, can I go travel? Can I go skydiving? Can I go hiking? Can I go fishing? And I'm like, you do what you want to. There's no limitations to you. As long as you are physically able to do those things, you know, certainly, from my perspective, you don't have to have any stops on your life after transplant once you've recovered. Yes, there are going to be certain cautions, restrictions that you will always have to abide by, which have now been amplified by the pandemic, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But even before that, transplant patients, we would always tell them to be cautious about crowds, always tell them to, you know, be very particular about hand hygiene, wearing a mask where there's a lot of people, because you don't want them picking up respiratory viruses and getting sick from that, because that can directly affect their transplanted lungs and cause more problems for them than anybody else who doesn't have a transplant.
Yeah.
There are certain precautions that we all tell, and these are common to all our transplant patients, is, you know, if I generally tell my patients, don't be out and about farming, be in soils, but if that is something you can't live without, wear a mask, wear a glove so that, you know, you're not exposed to funguses which live in the soil, which can cause trouble for you. Be always religious about taking your medicines at the times prescribed and the way they have been prescribed. If you run into any sort of trouble, in addition to seeking medical care, your first phone call should be to your transplant team and let them know this is going on. Most of the times we will ask you to come straight to the transplant center for medical attention. But if you live further away, we'll ask you to go to your local pulmonologist or your ER and have them contact us for further advice. do not delay seeking medical attention after a transplant, because things can spiral out of control very, very quickly if not addressed.
Yeah, I've had to learn as a patient, the biggest complaint that my doctors have had with me historically is that I'm too stoic and I don't complain enough, you know, about my symptoms that might be important for them to know. I'm one who just doesn't like to complain a lot, but I've learned to report any unusual symptoms to them. And I'm quite comfortable now with the idea of doing that. So I think it's important for patients to report to their doctors on any unusual things that are going on with them and not try and heal themselves. And so I'd be remiss, you know, if I didn't speak about COVID-19 and how it's altered the course of outcomes for lung transplantation at Baylor, if it has at all, and what the future looks like in your estimation in the face of COVID-19.
Yeah, you know, we are now 1.5 years or even longer than that, approaching 2 years into the pandemic. And it is, COVID-19 is here to stay. It's a part of our life. I don't expect it to go away. I fully expect us to learn how to live with it. And as we are evolving along with it, and the virus keeps on outsmarting us. So, and we have to keep finding new ways to stay a step ahead of it. Lung transplantation in COVID-19 came into being last year in the summer when the first patient underwent a lung transplant in the United States at Northwestern University. And this was necessitated due to the fact that patients who got COVID-19 were getting very sick. They were going into these episodes of respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation, breathing tubes, and the ventilator to keep their oxygen numbers up, actually ending up on ECMO. And these were young people, and they were not getting better despite these therapies. And by the time the acute illness went away, they were left with these lungs, which looked horrible on a chest x-ray and a CT scan. They were so scarred that there was no chance left at recovery. We performed our first lung transplant for COVID-19 at Baylor in October 15th, 2020, and was a very sick young man, 51 years old, who was transferred to us from San Antonio and on ECMO, about 3 months on being on ECMO. And he had no chance at beating COVID-19 unless he got a transplant. So we took the chance, we transplanted him. It was a long recovery because he got so deconditioned, so sick from COVID-19. It took him months after transplant to get back to his normal level of functioning back in San Antonio. But now you are 10 months out, he's on room air, back with his family, living his normal life. We've since done 10 lung transplants here at Baylor for COVID-19 patients. All our patients have done really well, and we've been able to save these patients. And we are actually inundated with requests for patients to be transferred over for transplant evaluations, and it's younger and younger patients, but we are limited by staffing challenges, which are not unique to us, but all across the healthcare system right now. We don't have enough nurses or ICU-trained perfusionists to take care of these patients who are getting sick with COVID and are in different smaller hospitals around the state of Texas or even neighboring states.
Yeah, it's amazing, because with the emergence of the variant and all, what people have to understand is we need the people who support the therapies, including perfusionists, and there aren't that many to go around, so that if there's a greater need for them, that presents a big problem. So there's a ripple effect, basically, with all of these things that have to be figured out on the fly, as we're doing right now. In medicine, it's interesting, and at the same point, a little daunting to think about all the challenges.
Right.
Yeah. We received word here in New York, and I guess throughout the country, that a third vaccine, a booster, if you will, is recommended sooner than later for most people. And certainly, we're concerned with people who are immunosuppressed. Can you talk a little bit about the vaccine and the situation with people who are immunosuppressed, and perhaps your advice for post-transplant patients?
Right. So that's an extremely important point, and thank you for bringing it up, Gary. Vaccines are one way to beat COVID-19. One of the challenges in post-transplant patients, as we've learned from the data that we've gotten so far, is patients do not mount a response after the vaccine, similar to a person who is not immunosuppressed. So the data published so far shows there antibody response after the two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine is suboptimal. That led to more trials. And recently, just last week, FDA said all immunocompromised patients, which includes all organ transplant patients, should go ahead and get their third or the booster dose of either Pfizer, if you've had Pfizer, or Moderna, if you've had Moderna vaccine. Mm-hmm. A lot of our patients have been asking us for this, and we were waiting for direction from the FDA. I'm glad we do have it. And it's come at the right time when Delta variant is peaking and surging. So we started giving the third booster dose to our patients in our clinic earlier this week. And the folks who are living further out from their transplant center can just go into their neighborhood pharmacies to get their booster doses. It's extremely important. Also, on the other side is if you are going to be listed, please talk to your transplant centers. For our specific Baylor St. Luke's Medical Transplant Center, we are now requiring all patients get vaccinated before they go onto the lung transplant list. Not only does it protect you against COVID, but we also know that after transplant, because of your immune system being suppressed, you do not mount a good antibody response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting. And I guess we'll have to see what's happening in the coming weeks and months with regard to the vaccines and what the experts feel is necessary for all of us to survive and protect each other. So this has been so interesting. I want to thank you for all of this incredibly valuable information. It's so valuable. And finally, I'd like to end by asking you, how do you see the role of social media with regard to COVID-19 and the role that healthcare professionals have in disseminating useful information in the face of social media?
That's a great question that you bring up, Gary. Thank you. Social media is a powerful tool which is accessible to everybody and on everybody's fingertips now, whether it's through Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram. People use it as their primary source of information or truth that may be based on your friend circles and what pops up on your newsfeed. So while there's a lot of misinformation and which has led to vaccine hesitancy in terms of COVID-19 and even for other medical topics out there, I think it's extremely important that we as healthcare professionals also participate in these discussions, connect with patient advocacy forums, support groups, and the societies like for lungs, it is American Thoracic Society or International Society of Heart Lung Transplantation, and having these honest and open discussions with our patients and families where they are given an opportunity to speak to us or get in touch with us. So we have to be responsible and participate in these discussions and can push the scientific message out to all our patients. So yes, I believe in responsible use of social media and participating in it just to help allay the fears and to connect with my patients and other healthcare professionals in the field.
Well, yeah. And thank you for that, because it's important. Most people communicate in that way at this point. And so thank you for making that so clear to us. It's been my great honor to have you as a guest on the Heart of the Matter. On behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all you've done in your local community in Texas and everyone else across the country and in the global heart health community with your extraordinary contributions and accomplishments and with your incredible dedication to your work there at Baylor in an effort to extend people's lives. And thank you for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you so much, Gary, for having me on your podcast. This was very enjoyable for me, and I look forward to continuing our interactions.
Yeah, I think after I get my new heart, perhaps if I'm lucky enough to get that, we'll do this again someday soon, and I'll tell you how that all worked out. But thank you for sharing this. I'm so appreciative of this information. It's so valuable and interesting. I really appreciate your time today. That is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at theheartguyspeaks.com for upcoming podcasts, or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization, you can also be a guest on the Heart of the Matter podcast. Please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and several other platforms. You just have to search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter. And until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.